Young, it's here and now. In a moment, we'll put the veto politics in Washington in historical perspective and also ask an historian, have other embattled presidents seemed this cheerful? But first, Iraqi government officials say the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq is dead, killed in a fight today between insurgents. But they acknowledge they don't have the body of the man known as Abu Ayyub al-Masri, or the Egyptian. The U.S. military isn't confirming his death either, and a militant group in Iraq denies the story. And al-Masri has also been reported dead at least once before. For the latest, we turn to Agence France-Presse, Baghdad reporter Joseph Kraus. And Joseph, what is the Iraqi government saying about al-Masri, first of all? One correspondent we contacted earlier today said he's watching on television there and called the story fishy.
Well, I think with any reports like this one about leaders of the insurgency being killed or wounded or captured, these come out fairly frequently, and I think they always have to be received with a certain amount of skepticism. What we know at this point is that certain sources within the Interior Ministry here in Baghdad have confirmed that Abu Ayyub al-Masri was killed in fighting north of the city, but the ministry itself has not confirmed that, and U.S. officials have also not confirmed it. So it still remains to be seen what exactly happened, but the reports have been out there.
Remind us, you've done a lot of reporting in Egypt. Who is Abu Ayyub al-Masri, and is that even his real name?
It's true. There is a lot of debate about Abu Ayyub al-Masri's name, and there's a lot of debate about his precise place in the Iraqi insurgency. His name, Abu Ayyub al-Masri, is the name that U.S. officials refer to him by. Al-Masri, of course, means the Egyptian. Al-Qaeda refers to him as Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, which al-Muhajir is Arabic for the immigrant, or can also be translated to mean exile. So there's a lot of disagreement over which name he should be referred to by, and it's pretty clear that both of those names are probably nom de guerre anyway. We spoke to one person in Cairo, an expert on Islamist movements there, who said that his real name is actually Yusuf al-Dardiri. But as with so much about this character, that really cannot be ascertained for certain.
Well, the importance to many people is that he is a foreigner in Iraq. You spoke with an Egyptian expert on political Islam. He's at Cairo's Al-Haram Center for Strategic Studies. And he told you that he thinks that Americans are eager to establish a non-Iraqi identity for the successor to the previous al-Qaeda leader. That was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed in Iraq last year, or Jordanian. And this person told you that Americans need to have his successor and the man who is alleged to be killed today to be a foreign fighter and not an Iraqi. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think it does fit into the way that U.S. officials would like to portray al-Qaeda in Iraq. They very much emphasize that it is a foreign movement made up of foreign fighters, and I think that's because they're working very hard at trying to split it away from the rest of Iraq. Al-Qaeda, of course, wants to portray the opposite. They very much want to show that they are an Iraqi force, that they have solidarity with the Iraqi people, and so they would have certain reasons for wanting to downplay the foreignness of this leader, if in fact he is Egyptian, as I think most people are convinced. So I think that would explain the discrepancy between the two names and why both sides speak about him very differently.
Well, which is true? You report that, in fact, there are reports of groups that were once sympathetic to insurgents and al-Qaeda have now switched. What are you seeing?
There are several Sunni tribes in the western province of Anbar which have formally turned against al-Qaeda. They have decided to at least temporarily fight alongside U.S. and Iraqi forces against al-Qaeda in that region. There are also reports that several of the more nationalistic insurgency groups in Iraq are also fed up with al-Qaeda, and that they might be working on the same thing, perhaps temporarily aligning with U.S. and Iraqi forces against al-Qaeda.
Well, only this week, the U.S. commanding general in Iraq, David Petraeus, said al-Qaeda in Iraq was public enemy number one. It's their actions that are sparking, you know, the bulk of sectarian violence between Iraqi Sunnis and Shias. Some people are discounting that, but he put the number of al-Qaeda in Iraq in the dozens. Is that surprising to you, given that the U.S. military has been focused on fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq since the war started 4 years ago? And now we're hearing that perhaps it's just several dozen people that can create such turmoil.
I think in terms of numbers, al-Qaeda has always been considered to be very small. But I think that they do bring a lot of sophistication to the insurgency. A lot of them were trained abroad, so they bring a lot of expertise that's necessary for the really spectacular attacks that happen across Iraq that caused so many casualties and that have really fueled the conflict from the beginning.
Joseph Krauss, Baghdad correspondent for Agence France-Presse. Joseph, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, on this, the fourth anniversary of President Bush's so-called mission accomplished speech, when he announced the end of major combat operations in Iraq, wearing a jumpsuit and speaking under a banner that read, "Mission Accomplished," President Bush is heading to U.S. Central Command headquarters in Florida today to huddle with commanders running the Iraq war. Back in Washington, Congress is sending the president the funding bill that would call for troop withdrawal from Iraq later this year if benchmarks are not met. The president is expected to veto the $124.2 billion bill, then meet with lawmakers to try to come up with a way forward. This morning on the Today Show, Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania said a compromise bill might call for benchmarks to be met by Iraqi officials without tying those benchmarks to troop withdrawal. Well, to mark this moment in time for President Bush, we're joined by Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University. Welcome back, Julian.
Nice to be here.
Let's start first with the veto. It's only the president's second. The first was last year's veto of the bill that would have lifted a ban on federal funding for new embryonic stem cell research. So just two vetoes, two terms. Now, we know this president has used more signing statements than any other in history, and those are the statements that are inserted quietly into bills after they've been passed, saying that the president might not uphold that law. But how rare is it to only have two outright vetoes?
It's rare. This is a president that has not had to say no, or he has not had to explicitly say no. Most presidents have used the veto, especially in periods of divided government, and they have used it aggressively.
Give us a sense.
We saw that with Richard Nixon, who used the veto not only with war power legislation in 1973, but with all kinds of spending legislation. He used it to make a statement that he would not cave in to Democratic Congress. Gerald Ford, his successor, did the same, used the veto regularly on all sorts of legislation.
Give us some numbers.
I don't have the numbers offhand.
Well, we do know. I mean, you've told us Franklin Roosevelt tops the list, and he had 635.
Right, and that's a high number. But that range in the hundreds is not crazy, and it's expected. It's expected. But again, President Bush had united government for most of his presidency, is all under Republican control, and it was a very united Republican Party until recently. So he didn't actually have to use it, and when he did, he could do it quietly without much protest.
Well, and we should rush to say, we mentioned the signing statements. He's done hundreds of those, but they don't get much public attention. We'll put the law passed by Congress in context. Again, it calls for leaving some troops in Iraq, but for attaching most troop withdrawal to benchmarks set for the Iraqi governments. If the Iraqi government doesn't meet the benchmarks, then troops begin to withdraw. You know, put that call from Congress in context.
Look, that's not unlike what we saw in Vietnam. I mean, starting in 1969 and 70, there was a lot of pressure and proposals from Congress to create deadlines, to create a schedule for withdrawal, to create a sense of how the war would end. And every year, congressmen would propose this. It didn't pass, actually. It takes a long time until 1973 that you get real concrete legislation. It's happening quicker here. But this is exactly the sort of thing that Congress does.
I want you to pick up on that, because you've been quoted all over the place today in reports as saying that the big deal about today's bill going to the White House was that it got to the president's desk pretty early from an historical perspective. Now, anti-war activists might be astonished at that, because it feels like a long time coming, but tell us more about that.
That's true, and that was the same complaint with Vietnam. The point is, when you're in a big war, it's very hard to extricate yourself. It's hard to do it strategically, but politically, it's hard for politicians to just say, end it, period. And so, you know, we're within a few years, and we've had a Democratic Congress take a vote that no one expected them to do. They sent to the president's desk with their names on it that we want to withdraw to begin right now. So as frustrating as it might be to the anti-war left, this is still a pretty bold move.
Well, and you also say that it's surprising in some ways, even after Democrats won the majority in Congress in 2006, they didn't think then, just that short while ago that this could be happening today.
Yeah, we have to remember the Democrats are a party haunted by the ghosts of George McGovern. It's a party that has been attacked repeatedly as weak on defense. And even after the 2006 election, many people were skeptical, would Democrats actually vote on something like a withdrawal deadline, even knowing it would be vetoed? Would they take that step knowing what attacks are going to come in 2008? And they have. And as frustrating, again, as that might be for some on the left, it's still a change in how Democrats are willing to talk, willing to vote.
Well, and yet, what might be the possible fallout for Democrats? Let's just stay there for a second, because some are surprised to hear that the bill calls for troops to remain behind to fight insurgent forces as opposed to get involved in the sectarian violence. And Democrats knew going in that the president was going to veto this. They might have the appearance of just, as they're being accused by President Bush, of just doing something politically, knowing that, in fact, they don't mean for an pull out because they know the president will veto it. On the other hand, they also risk letting down core constituents who are finding out, well, wait a minute, you're calling for, it's not full withdrawal.
Yes, it's a dangerous vote. I mean, on the left, they're going to get it for not doing enough. And from the right, they're going to get it for doing too much. Traditional problem the Democrats face. So it's all going to depend not just on what comes out in the final compromise, but what comes next. I mean, what we saw in Vietnam was every year Democrats would go back to the table and try to get more in terms of ending the war. And so it's all going to be what happens this summer, what happens this fall after these benchmarks are set, which I think is the likely compromise. Then what do Democrats do? Do they leave things in place or do they then become tougher and more aggressive with the president? And that, I think that's going to be the key.
We're coming up on the break. We want to talk about, you know, your thoughts about possibility for compromise, more comparisons with Vietnam. In the meantime, one major difference that we can see outright is that this battle over funding is about two wars.
Yes, and I think that has complicated matters for Democrats. It's about the war on terrorism and it's about the war in Iraq. Republicans have tried to keep these things together since 2003, 2002, and Democrats have tried to separate them. And I think that's part of the trick or the strategy that Democrats are trying to do. This is about Iraq. It's not about the war on terrorism, and we'll see if they succeed.
Now, we're talking with Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University, also the editor of a book coming out next year about American politics in the 1970s. It's called Rightward Bound. We are doing this today because 4 years ago today, President Bush stood under a banner that read, Mission Accomplished. 4 years later, the war still on. As Julian said, the war in Afghanistan still on. We'll have more with Julian when we come back. And later in the program, inside one of the more mysterious places on Earth, North Korea, here's President Bush talking about the bill yesterday, back to that topic, and why he plans to veto it.
It's got artificial timetables for withdrawal. But that's not the only bad thing about the bill. It also imposes the judgment of people here in Washington on our military commanders and diplomats.
Back with much more with Julian Zelitzer after a very quick break, here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University, putting today in some historical context as Congress sends a bill for war funding to the president, and the president promises to veto it probably by tomorrow. And you know, Julian, we've talked with you about this before. You've been mentioning comparisons to Vietnam. Is Iraq, in your view, becoming the Republican Party's Vietnam?
I think so. I mean, I think so in two respects. The first is this has been associated with the Republican Party of the war, just as Democrats really launched Vietnam. And the war undermined the political strength of the Republicans. That's what's happened with Iraq. And the war really undermined the political strength of Democrats with Vietnam. So there's a very similar comparison in the political effects this war has had. Both wars also undermined the broader strategy of American foreign policy. With Vietnam, the whole Cold War strategy came under fire, came under question. And we've seen the same with the war on terrorism. I think Iraq is raising questions about how this has been conducted. So I think there's a lot of similarities we're seeing.
A big difference, though, as you mentioned, President Nixon vetoed bills that were passed to try to end the war, slow down the war in Vietnam. Congress was able to override some of those, but today's Congress, analysts are saying, will not be able to override the president's veto.
Probably not at this point. It's all going to depend, look, in the next few years, what happens with the Republicans in Congress? Do they break with their own party or not? Do they break with their president or not? I still think as 2008 gets closer, we're going to see more dissenting voices. Today, many Republicans said they don't agree with the president on Iraqi benchmarks. And those are the kind of divisions that I think Democrats are counting for in the next series of battles.
We talked about the political pitfalls for Democrats, but E.J. Dionne, the columnist in the Washington Post, says the burden of proof in this debate is really on the president now, that he needs to convince the American people a decent result is possible in Iraq. If we shouldn't have a timetable now, how long, you know, do we keep troops? How does he answer that question? You know, how long are troops in Iraq? Do you agree?
It's a huge question, and he's absolutely right. I mean, a lot of attention is focused on what's the potential threat to the Democrats, but we've already seen the threat to the Republicans and to this presidency. The Republican Party is embattled, and so is this president. He's not accomplished much, and really his biggest policy right now is a failure. So the burden isn't on the Democrats. The burden really politically is on the president to make good of this war somehow.
It would seem a big burden for many people. And then you add to that other conflicts right now. The architect, one of the architects of the war in Iraq, Paul Wolfowitz, fighting for his job at the World Bank, close friend of President Bush, Alberto Gonzalez, fighting for his job as Attorney General. April just recorded the deadliest month of the year so far for the American military in Iraq, 104 service members killed. And we were watching the video recently, which was delightful in some ways, of President Bush dancing with some AIDS activists. But behind that, a question floated up, and I'm not sure if it did for you as well. Why does he seem so happy, you know, given all of this bad news? Have you thought about that, you know, his visage?
Yeah, I mean, this is a president who does not convey any sense of worry, even as all these events happen. Other presidents we've seen physically look much more worried. We saw that with Nixon toward the end of his presidency, looking dark and gloomy. Mm. We saw that with Reagan during Iran-Contra, looking like a humbled president, a man who was always a ray of optimism. We saw that with President Clinton during the impeachment, a really kind of embattled personal president. And we have not seen that from President Bush yet. And I would suspect privately that president, that kind of feeling is there, but publicly he has not conveyed any of it.
Well, what are historians saying about all of this? I mean, you've given us your point of view. Is that the preponderance of view of historians? I mean, you guys have journals, you exchange ideas. Are there those saying otherwise?
There's not many historians who are championing the Bush presidency. I would start by saying many historians tend to be liberal. So to be fair, you don't have as many conservative voices. But in general, this is not a presidency that's going down well. Even for people, historians who disagree politically with the president, they're not yet finding issues or exceptional areas where the president seems successful. There is no detente like we had for Reagan, the relations with the Soviet Union. There is no deficit reduction like we saw with Clinton. Some issue other than the failures. And so historians are coming down badly so far in the presidency.
You almost wonder if what we're going to see between now and not just, I mean, there's two timetables here, one regarding the war in Iraq, the other, the 2008 elections. And you almost wonder if we might see the unthinkable, President Bush going to North Korea. You're shaking your head, yes. Just something, I mean, this is real crystal ball.
Right.
Thinking, but to do, as you said, other presidents have done in
that
position.
That's what Nixon did this and Reagan did this. They did something dramatic and completely unexpected. Nixon goes to China. Reagan makes peace with the Soviets. There's no sign, though, that Bush is working on that. And there is no sign that diplomacy, which has been a bad word in the Bush administration, is about to regain ground. That would be something dramatic. I mean, that could refocus attention on gains in the war on terrorism rather than failures with the war in Iraq.
One last quick question to Julian Zelitzer, again, professor of history at Boston University. Very current news. General Petraeus said last week that sectarian violence in Iraq is declining, but that al-Qaeda remains public enemy number one. Even though he said there's only dozens of al-Qaeda operatives, Peter Kanellis, writing about this in the Boston Globe, compared George Tenet and General Petraeus saying what the president wanted to hear to others in the past who have remained very independent. And he feels that there's sort of a compromise of independence in this White House. Your thoughts on that?
That's true. I mean, one of the stories coming out of this new book by Tenet and other, Gonzalez and the firing of prosecutors, is that everyone is completely loyal to the president, to the point of, willing to do anything, willing to say anything, and willing to suppress evidence. This has happened in other presidencies. It's not all new to President Bush. That is, I think, a bit unfair. But it's clearly been part of the revelation and the story of how the Bush administration has operated, not to Bush's benefit. I mean, that's the irony of it. I think he wanted more independence. It might have benefited him.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University. Julian, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow on Here Now, we want to note, as Jamestown celebrates its 400th birthday, historian Jill Lepore will be with us. And she says, when you think of Jamestown, you might also think of Iraq. And we'll find out why she makes that comparison. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the gender pay gap, still there. Back with more Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Equal pay for equal work. That was the rallying cry of the women's movement in the 1970s. Well, they might want to dust off those placards. According to a new study, women make 20% less than men as soon as they get into the workforce. And 10 years after that, women take home 31% less than their male counterparts. The study was done by the American Association of University Women. The AAUW took into account things like choice of career field, number of hours worked, and time taken off to raise children, and concluded that after those were factored, the pay gap was still there, and it was due in part to sex discrimination. The group is backing two pieces of federal legislation to correct the differences. The Fair Pay Act and the Paycheck Fairness Act, both under debate in the House and Senate. Dr. Catherine Hill is director of research for the AAUW. She co-authored the study, Behind the Pay Gap, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's make clear, you looked at college graduates just 1 year out of school to compare men's and women's salaries, because both at that time had what, minimal experience?
That's right. We looked at college graduates 1 year, and then we also looked at them 10 years after graduation. We looked at women and men who graduated from four-year colleges in 1999, 2000, and they were interviewed in 2001. We also looked at college graduates from an earlier group, from 1992-93 graduates. They were interviewed in 1994 and then again in the year 2003.
Right. Now, you found that women in that first year already made 20% less than men at the starting gate. So, you know, I'm sure people have questions. Is that, for instance, because men choose higher paying fields or tend to choose higher paying fields such as engineering?
Yes, it is true that part of the difference in men and women's wages can be explained by the choice of field of study and the kinds of jobs that men and women have. However, not all of the gap can be explained that way. We found that even controlling for all the factors that we know affect earnings, and one of those factors is the kind of field of study, the kinds of jobs people take, the hours worked, all these different factors we know affect earnings, even when we control for all of these, we still end up with a 5% difference between men and women right out of the starting gate in that first year. After 10 years, we see a 12% difference that we can't explain using any of these other variables.
Well, and we just want to underscore that by saying, for instance, that men make up 82% of engineering majors, women 79% of education majors. So that those are the different fields that we're talking about. You also looked within the same fields, and within the fields, you found that women are still earning less.
That's right. Women can't simply choose a major that will allow them to avoid the pay gap. we found a pay gap among men and women who had the same college major. For example, in biology and in science, women earn only 75% as much as men earn just 1 year after college. Likewise, in mathematics, a field that's traditionally been a male-dominated field, women are earning only 75% as much as their male counterparts. That's just 1 year after college.
Well, you know, what's interesting is the ripple effect of this kind of equation. You write that because couples, for instance, when they get married, realize that the woman is making less than the man, they start to prioritize their family life that way. In other words, if the woman's job is going to be lower paying, it's the man's job that's going to be more supported. Explain
that
more.
That's right. And even a small difference at the beginning of the career can really start to add up over time as the couple prioritizes the man's job to a greater extent. And then we see these things sort of accumulate over the course of the career. So small differences in the beginning can start to really add up.
Right. And for some women, this might be the absolute choice that they want to make, to stay home and to raise their children. But let's talk about child care. I mean, how much is, you know, the fact that women are far more likely to take time out of their labor to have labor?
Yes.
You know, how much does that impact? Is that part of why the gap grows over 10 years? Or how much of a factor was child care?
Well, certainly we did find a difference in the amount of time that mothers and fathers take out of the workplace. 10 years out, we saw actually that about 23% of mothers were not in the workplace. Another 17% were working part-time. Among fathers, we found 1% of fathers were out of the workplace and only 2% were working part-time. So there was a very big difference.
Do you think the fact that women do drop out, and again, we rush to say many times it's exactly what they want to do, to stay home and raise their children, but the fact that they do, does that affect how employers gauge how much they're going to pay women? Is there an anticipation that women might leave, and so perhaps that's why we pay them less?
Right. No, I think that certainly women are more likely to make that choice, and in part, that does explain the pay gap, but it doesn't explain the whole pay gap. I want to just reiterate that point, that we did take into account, for example, leaves out of the workplace over that 10-year period, so we do account for that, and that does have an effect on earnings, but that 12% difference is not explained by those choices.
Another study by your group, the American Association of University Women, addresses the earnings gap between men and women by state. And it's interesting. It shows, for instance, women earn 64% of what men earn in Louisiana. And then there's West Virginia, the smallest gap. Women in West Virginia make 89% as much as men. We were thinking it might have been New York or California or states that are considered liberal-minded, but it's West Virginia that has the smallest gap between men and women. Why is that?
You know, one of the ironic things that we found is that there tends to be a larger gap among highly educated women and men than there are over the workplace as a whole. So a state like Massachusetts, where a very large percentage of people have college degrees and advanced professional degrees, you actually see a somewhat higher gap, a larger gap, than you do among states where there are fewer people with advanced degrees.
Your organization has a suggestion for narrowing the gaps. What's that?
We have a number of suggestions. One is we certainly want to encourage employers to adopt some family-friendly policies, and I think some of the best employers are already doing that. We also recommend that parents and women and girls themselves continue to challenge sex segregation in the workplace and in field of study.
What do you mean sex segregation?
We really continue to see that there are male fields in school and female fields in school, and we see the same thing in the workplace. We see that there are men's jobs and women's jobs.
You also talk about encouraging and protecting workers who want to talk about pay. That is a big problem, that sometimes you don't know if you're paid less because you don't know what other people are paid. I mean, there's privacy issues.
That's absolutely right. People really don't, I think most people don't know if they're paid fairly. And one of the things that the new legislation that is being considered in Congress is looking at is this question of protecting workers who want to discuss their pay with their colleagues.
But what about privacy issues? And we do want to talk about the two pieces of legislation that are out there right now, and your group backs both of them, the Paycheck Fairness Act and the Fair Pay Act. But what about privacy? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, the legislation would not require individuals to reveal their salaries. It would protect workers who choose to talk about their earnings with one another. So that would mean that an employer could not retaliate against a worker who chose to discuss it with a colleague.
Yeah.
But I think at the same time, it's also very important for us to talk about it. I think that people need to get good information. The best employers, I think, also have figured out that having a fair and straightforward pay system is good for morale.
Dr. Catherine Hill, Director of Research for the American Association of University Women. She co-authored a new study, Behind the Pay Gap, that shows that women, either a year out of college or 10 years on, still make less than their male counterparts. Dr. Hill, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And to find out more about the Fair Pay Act and the Paycheck Fairness Act, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Still ahead, a photographic journey to the other side of the DMZ. You're listening to Here and Now. It's May Day, May 1st, known as the International Day of the Worker. Immigration reform marches are planned from Oregon to Florida, with two of the largest demonstrations set for Los Angeles County. Well, May Day has its roots in pagan celebrations, but its modern-day history began right here in the U.S. James Green is professor of history and labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston and author of Death in the Haymarket, about the first modern May Day. Professor, we know that in the 1800s there was a growing movement in the U.S. to demand an 8-hour workday, and that culminated in Chicago in 1886. Tell us about that.
Yes, the first May Day, and the reason May Day became an international holiday for workers, is because of what happened in Chicago in 1886, a general strike, something unprecedented in the United States and Europe, of over 300,000 workers demanding the shorter workday. It was a very peaceful, even joyful, festive demonstration. You know, people were out in the springtime and the sun marching, and it looked like workers would achieve the 8-hour day at that moment, but things didn't work out that way.
What happened 3 days later?
One of the strikes turned violent. When the police arrived, someone, and to this day we don't know who it was, threw a bomb, landed in the midst of the police ranks, killing one policeman right away and six more later, and this became the notorious and tragic Haymarket affair, and it really killed the 8-hour movement and that sort of visionary radical wing of the labor movement.
Right. And it was obviously resurrected later, but at the time it was equated with anarchy.
Right. The whole 8-hour movement got painted with that brush of terror and communism, and it really was an unfair charge, but it stuck for quite a while.
Right. Well, as we mentioned today, immigrants across the country are holding rallies demanding a path to citizenship. These are workers. This is the new workforce. How does today's struggle reflect what happened in the past?
Well, there are some stunning similarities. Most of the people in the streets in Chicago in 1886 were immigrants. They were from Germany, you know, not from Mexico. But they were demonstrating not so much as immigrants, but as workers. And if you look closely at what the demonstrators were saying last year, they were really presenting themselves as people who do the necessary, often dirty, low-paid work, and yet don't have any of the rights of American citizens. So in some ways, the revival of May Day last year and this year is a reiteration of what the first May Day was about.
It's interesting, in doing the research, we realized that the first May Day was in the 1800s, but in the 1700s, Philadelphia workers went on strike to demand a 10-hour workday. So, you know,
right.
It's really a sense of how much workers have had to fight.
Yeah, and how many people have lost their lives, actually, for something that I hope we don't take it for granted today, but some people do. It was a long and hard fight over 100 years or so.
James Green, professor of history and labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston and author of Death in the Haymarket, about the history of today, May Day. Professor Green, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we mentioned, May Day began as a pagan celebration of spring and fertility. It was called Beltane, and it's a tradition that survives today. This morning, a crowd gathered on the banks of the Charles River here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to mark May Day with Morris dancing, songs of spring, and a twirl around the maple.
I'm David, and this is Mike, and we're two of the many to come from the Newtown Morrismen. I don't know how many Morris groups will be here this morning.
They'll all be here by 5:30. Oh, I'm Janet Scudder. I'm with Muddy River Morris. I don't think I've missed a May in 30 years.
So. I'm putting on my kit right now. These are the bells.
We're dressed in all white, and we have suspenders that are our colors of red and blue. And then we have armbands that also have the red and blue kind of streamers on the end.
My name's Stuart Freed. The bells, the hankies, and the sticks that we use in our dancing are to wake up the earth, to scare off evil spirits. The ribbons are to remind us of the bright flowers of the spring.
May Day morning on the banks of the Charles River in Cambridge, Massachusetts, produced by Here Now's George Hicks. Stay with us. Just ahead, photographer Mark Edward Harris takes us inside North Korea, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A singing waitress has her picture taken by a customer with a cell phone. Actors in costume await their call at a film studio backlot. Children perform in a school play. It could be anywhere. But in these photographs, the actors are playing soldiers from the year 918. The children attend school in a palace with a 2,000-seat theater. And in every picture, there's not one speck of dirt or litter or anything out of place, because these pictures are a rare look inside North Korea. Photographer Mark Edward Harris made two visits to North Korea. His new coffee table book is Inside North Korea. You can follow along at our website, here-now.org. And Mark joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome.
Robin, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You give us such great insight, but remind us how tough it is for a journalist in North Korea. What were the restrictions put on you?
We could not go more than 100 meters away from our minders or leave the hotel on our own more than 100 meters. So there were restrictions. But that said, I was able to shoot pretty much at will on my travels throughout. Well, actually, no, very big restrictions at the DMZ from the north side. But around Pyongyang, the Arirang-Mass Games.
In fact, let's talk about those games and look at those pictures. These are the huge – they're not really games, are they, as much as exhibits?
They're mass performances, 10,000 to 20,000 students holding up placards, forming mosaics. There's one of Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea that passed away in 1994. Soldiers marching all over the place, performers. It really is – like Cirque du Soleil times 100.
Yeah, it's hard to get across. I mean, the expanse of performances as if the Super Bowl was, you know, on steroids.
Right.
How did it feel to be there?
Overwhelming. Madeleine Albright was there in 2000, and I think she was equally awestruck by the precision of it, the immensity of it. The only thing that throws people off a bit, is, I think, is that it's referred to as games because you keep expecting some sort of athletic competition to take place, and that is not the case.
Did people seem to enjoy themselves, or did it feel as if they were just there holding up their placard because they were told to?
Well, you have the students holding up the placards, and they're on the opposite side of the field. I would think that the students doing that day after day, that could get pretty monotonous. But the audience definitely seemed to be into it. You know, it's not something obviously they see every day, and it's definitely something that I had never witnessed on such a grand scale before.
Another thing you photograph is the architecture and the signs everywhere with the sloganeering. But I want to point you to page 36, which is the Arc de Triomphe, higher than Paris is and very duly noted on the structure.
Each place has a local tour guide as well, and the first thing they point out is, you know, our arch is higher than the one in Paris. Massive structures. I mean, something, you know, that is a very Soviet-type thing going on. And after all, you know, 1953, when the shooting stopped, the Soviets came in. And so the architecture you have is very Soviet-oriented. People live in mass, concrete block-style apartment complexes. Their monuments are monumental. It's interesting, though, when you look at the photographs, is the lack of cars around. In fact, somebody joked that if you can get hit by a car in Pyongyang, you should get an award because there's so few cars on the street, and actually surprisingly few bicycles. For people that have been to China, they're used to, in China years ago, there are just bikes everywhere. You don't see that in Pyongyang. They have an excellent metro system, and they have trolleys. But surprisingly, little movement from place to place about the city.
You have two beautiful pictures. Well, there are many beautiful, but two in particular that span across two pages each. One is a huge white expanse. The other is a huge crater in the middle of a range of mountains. Mm-hmm. This is Mount Pektu on the Korean-Chinese border. Mm-hmm. This is an area sacred, isn't it?
Right. All Koreans, both sides of the DMZ, and since the beginning of the nation, going way back to the earliest times on the peninsula, it's their spiritual home. They believe that they're descended, I believe, from a tiger and a bear coming together in Mount Pektu. Kim Jong-il is said to have been born there, though historical records indicate that he was actually born during World War II in the Soviet Union. But it helps propaganda to think that he was born, you know, the spiritual homeland for all Koreans. Difficult to get to. I flew into Manchuria and then climbed up the mountain in midwinter, discovered that I was in the middle of a blizzard and really couldn't see too much. And so I returned 2 months later and then saw the spectacular crater lake. And then I also traversed, flowing out of the mountain from one side to the east is the Tumen River, which separates North Korea and China. And then from the other side is the Amak River, which we know and the Chinese refer to as the Yalu River, which obviously was very famous because of the Korean War. And we tried to fight up to that border right across from Dandong, China. And the Chinese threatened that if we came up, you know, close to that, they would enter the war, and they kept their promise.
I want to just make sure we've commented on the last couple of photos in your book. One we understand is a favorite of yours, and it's on the last page, and it has sort of a riddle in it. Tell us what this means. It's a beautiful mural, train tracks going away from the viewer, and on each side, green grass that goes off to rolling hills, a huge skyline. It's sort of a panorama you could see in Kansas. And it's at the Dorasan station, and it reads, "Not the last station from the south, but the first station toward the north." The mileage sign points to Seoul and Pyongyang. What does that mean?
Well, this is the hope of the vast majority of Koreans on the peninsula on both sides of the DMZ, is reunification. And so right now, the tracks have been joined. It's just a matter of the governments coming together to let the trains go back and forth. You know, the capitals of the two countries are basically 150 miles apart, and it really is the goal of the people on both sides to join. Now, how that will happen, if it will happen.
And when.
And when are the big questions that no book can answer right now.
Right. In the meantime, to underscore, you have another photograph of a photo hanging on a barbed wire fence on the south side of a man crying. He was separated from his family. His family is in north. He's in the south. He's sitting there. And the caption reads, "I would go, but I can't."
Right. There's a million families separated by the DMZ. There are some family reunions, but it's in the hundreds. And as I said, there's up to a million families separated. Most will never get to see their family members that they last saw. Little children, you know, brothers and sisters separated. Now they're in their 80s, so they're dying off and just might never see their family members again. Hopefully the next generation will not have to live through that nightmare.
Photographer Mark Edward Harris, his new book of photos of North Korea is Inside North Korea. To see some of them, don't forget, go to our website, here-now.org. Mark, thanks so much for sharing them with us.
Robin, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Whoa, I got sad news this morning. People having trouble over in Korea. Whoa. This morning, people having trouble way over in Korea. Well, some of our dear friends is missing. They don't know where they're over yonder. They don't know whether there's over here.
Lightning Hopkins, sad news from Korea. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
What in the world could my poor son be? Don't worry, Mom.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.